You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, April 7th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Greg Mitchell on When Hollywood Turned Left. Also on the program today, the CIA torture report explained. Michael Hayden, Dianne Feinstein, she's a little emotional. Also on the program today, Chris Christie may be feeling a little emotional today. Reports that David Wildstein is cooperating with federal investigators amid the recent report over the, I guess it was Friday, that a grand jury has convened on Bridgegate. You know what they say about grand juries? They could indict a ham sandwich in this case. I couldn't help myself, folks. I'm so sorry. It is important, though, because it does imply that the feds at least think that there was a federal statute that was violated. Also on the program today, former CEO now of Mozilla. Is he assassinated by gay people?
Gay mafia.
The gay mafia took him out. To follow up on that Cuban Twitter story, the bottom line is somebody made a lot of money setting up a social media site. I mean, that's, you really don't have to say anything else. And Jeb Bush announces that he will not be running for president he didn't announce that. He said that undocumented immigrants are not felons, which is an indication that he's not going to run for anything ever again in the Republican Party. A lot of people have a different perspective on that. They think that he's setting himself up for run. He is definitely setting himself up not to run, in my opinion.
That's like the next they'll come out and say, like, I think we ought to look at the Swedish financial model and social system for the United States.
That's right.
Okay, like, he's not running.
No.
Not happening.
No, I think that is a clear indication that he's happy playing golf or whatever it is that he does now. Yes, exactly. He's probably going to pick up painting now just to screw with his brother. First one to create a wonderful mise-en-scene of people being tortured wins the family prize. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will be talking to Greg Mitchell. I should also just note, today is the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide, where, depending on whose numbers you use, anywhere from 500,000 to a million Rwandans, mostly Tutsis, were killed in about 100-day span. Also note, unrelated, but elections in Afghanistan held over the weekend, and Friday, turnout very high. Take that for what it's worth. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Greg Mitchell. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Greg Mitchell. He is a daily blogger at The Nation magazine at nation.com, nationmagazine.com, author of over a dozen books. His most recent, an e-book, When Hollywood Turned Left, was derived from an earlier book of his, The Campaign of the Century, about Upton Sinclair's epic run for governor in California. And I should also say, also someone who has been really great at chronicling those who were cheerleaders of the Iraq invasion and occupation. Greg, welcome to the program. Greg.
Hello?
Welcome to the program. Sorry about that.
Okay. Thank you. I'm here, I think.
Yes. All right. So let's talk about this. You know, the like I mentioned in your intro, the When Hollywood Turned Left was derived in many respects, pulled out in your piece or your book, I should say, on Upton Sinclair's famous run for governor, the epic campaign. His campaign to end poverty in California. Just give us a little bit of background. I mean, the Hollywood turned left in some respects as a result of that campaign, but it was sort of a bank shot in a way.
Yeah, absolutely. Upton Sinclair ran for governor. He's a famous socialist and, of course, an author, as we all know, in 1934 as a Democrat in California in the depths of the Depression, leading a mass movement called End Poverty in California, or EPIC. And amazingly, he swept the Democratic primary and appeared headed for victory that November against a hack Republican. And that so frightened people out there and around the country that it inspired what I called in my book, The Campaign of the Century, the birth of the modern campaign. We saw the first use of, you know, political consultants from outside the political party, advertising whizzes from Madison Avenue, national fundraising for a state race. It set all records for a campaign, $10 million perhaps. And it inspired Hollywood's first all-out plunge into politics, including Irving Thalberg creating the first attack ads for the screen, which of course was a movie screen then, but it was the forerunner of all the attack ads we would later see on television. So it was quite a campaign, and I wrote the book about 20 years ago, and it's a 640-page book, and drew wide acclaim, won a top award, et cetera, et cetera. But people always said I should pull out the Hollywood stuff and for a more reader-friendly experience. So I've finally done that in an e-book. I've added new material as well, so it's not strictly just a reprint. There's new material, updated, and so on and so forth. So that's called When Hollywood Turned Left, and that's what it focuses on.
I want to get to sort of, the broader implications, both of, what that campaign told us about what was happening in America at the time, and also sort of the implications of, we've never really that campaign, I guess, set our politics on a trajectory, a path that maybe was inevitable, but maybe it wasn't, in terms of the way that we perceive politics and campaigns are waged. But, I mean, tell us what was going on that so, I guess, I don't want to say radicalized, because I think that may be an overstatement, but what politicized Hollywood?
Right. Well, you know, it surprises some people to learn today that Hollywood was once very right-wing. Almost all the moguls were conservative Republicans. Most of them were Jewish immigrants, very heavily involved. Louis B. Mayer of MGM was a Republican leader in California. And so they, you know, it was a more, much more of a conservative place. And the screenwriters and the actors guilds, which are, of course, became very strong later, were just founded in 1933. This is the year before this campaign. And they didn't have top stars involved at that time, very much up for grabs whether they would make it as unions. And so that's this race in 1934. We saw the moguls come out against Sinclair, work very actively. They threatened to move the studios to Florida. As one stunt, there's another stunt. Actually, I write about it and at The Nation today. If you go to The Nation site, you'll see my blog post from the book. They deducted one day's pay from every one of their employees, from the top stars to you know, equipment managers, and they basically just took one day's pay out of all the paychecks and donated it to GOP slush fund. So that was groundbreaking as well.
What was the legality of that at the time?
Oh, it didn't matter. I mean, California was run by Republicans. The studios were very powerful. So, I mean, they just did it. A few people resisted, you know, Jimmy Cagney, Billy Wilder. There were some exceptions. But the stunts along with the Thalberg attack ads on the screen, which is a series of three faked newsreels using Hollywood actors to portray, you know, Sinclair supporters who were endorsing the Soviet Union and communism, was so outrageous that it inspired this move to the left, which I focus on in this new ebook. This was the main, you know, there are obviously other reasons as well, but this was the prime mover in the sudden shift in the mid-1930s from a very conservative Hollywood to a much more liberal Hollywood. The two guild, the actors and the screenwriters guilds, finally took off. They staged strikes, and the actors and writers organized for Franklin Roosevelt, of course, and for other things, and they actually got one of Sinclair's top allies elected governor in 1938. And California has remained, you know, with a few exceptions, very liberal since. Hollywood itself has remained very liberal since. So this was really, really the turning point.
I mean, was it a function of just, you know, who these people were, or was it the overreach by the studio heads? They were basically run. These studios were run by, you know, just Sheldon, what we would perceive as like a Sheldon Adelson type,
right?
You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it was an overreach, you know, and it got people so outraged. I mean, Sinclair was a former socialist. He ran as a Democrat and swept the primary and was headed for victory. This is not an exaggeration. And he had one of the greatest mass movements in the history of America. So, and the book chronicles that as well. It's one of the great, great stories of the progressive past. And they were ready to win, basically. And so these extraordinary measures that I've mentioned, from the, you know, fundraising to all sorts of fake, dirty tricks, you know, it's an incredibly entertaining, you know, disgraceful story, but extremely entertaining because there were so many, you know, breakthroughs in terms of dirty tricks and Madison Avenue and, you know, all sorts of things that were done to defeat Sinclair. And, you know, spoiler alert, he did end up losing. Drew a, you know, record number of votes for a Democrat. This is very, California itself was very Republican then. So this changed the politics of California. It also pushed the New Deal to the left. You know, people forget that first couple of years of the new year, new deal, we didn't have, you know, the Social Security reform, et cetera, et cetera. And it really was after the Sinclair race and some other left-wing Democrats of 1934 that really pushed Roosevelt to the left. And so this was that's why I called my original book The Campaign of the Century, because it really was, you know, one of the most influential campaigns of our time. And but, you know, I was happy to do this Hollywood spinoff now.
And so, I mean, how much of what was happening in that campaign was a function of the time? How much further was Sinclair taking it? I mean, because it seems like it was sort of an analogy of what was happening nationwide.
Yeah, there was, you know, Roosevelt was elected in 32. It was hard to say what that meant, because it was a rejection of Hoover and Republicans. Roosevelt then took his first steps towards the New Deal. But, you know, to some extent, it was like Obama with Obamacare, which, you know, many on the left, you know, were happy he got something through, but extremely unhappy that it's so limited. And so you have people on the left who have... you know, are pushing for single payer or whatever. So it's similar to that, in the sense that the early days of the New Deal were certainly welcome, but the left wanted much more. And after 1934, you know, they got it. The most hallowed New Deal reforms that we speak of today came after 1934.
Now, I guess in some sense, at some level, it makes sense that the first attack ads would come out of Hollywood. But, I mean, talk about, you know, because this is the tools that these reactionary forces have at their disposal. Talk about what you see that was developed there that still continues to this day. I mean, aside, I guess, from attack ads.
Well, I mean, the attack ads was quite a breakthrough, because, this, you know, the... movie screen and later TV screen, of course, tremendously influential. People are there thinking they're going to see a down the middle, you know, report, sort of believe what they see on the screen. So to have these sort of faked newsreels, you know, people fell for it. And there were, you know, in places where there were a lot of Sinclair supporters in attendance, there were riots. Great protest, but by and large, it worked. The attack ads definitely swayed votes. Again, some people attribute them to the, you know, the defeat of Sinclair. So it really worked, and it gave, again, it gave a signal for the future on the use of filmed images. You know, there always were dirty tricks. There are, you know, it's not that dirty tricks were invented in this campaign, but the extent of them, the use of, you know, true professionals, outside people, experts, even Irving Thalberg, who is a saintly figure, and we all know of the Thalberg Award that's given every year on the Oscar broadcast. And it's just sort of shocking that even Thalberg would be involved in something like this.
And I mean, what at the time, was there any type of pushback? I mean, how did people react to this? Just, I mean, more from a perspective of the way it changed their sense of what Hollywood was and what that medium, I guess, could do in the wrong hands. Or was it, I mean, was there sort of some measure of awareness that this was problematic?
Yeah, well, that's why the actors and the writers and others in Hollywood took action. They sort of felt that this was the coming, coming main influencer of Americans in an entertainment world. You know, TV was still 20 years in the future, and so they, they sort of saw that, and we also saw importantly that. Hollywood then started making more what you might call progressive movies. Again, there always had been some social protest or social image type movies, but after 1934, there were many, many more. You know, Grapes of Wrath and so on. So the writers and the actors who were now in the ascendancy politically then felt free to produce more. You know, more liberal works, if you will, social protest, social issue types of movies, And of course, again, that continued for, you know, decades into the future. So, like I said, it's a surprise to many people that Hollywood was ever reactionary. You know, now it's many decades now where the liberals, let's put Ronald Reagan aside. But, you know, even Ronald Reagan, I never got a chance to talk to him about this campaign. But, you know, back then he was a Hollywood liberal, and he became head of the Actors Guild. And it wasn't until the blacklist days of the late 1940s that he turned to the right. But, you know, Reagan himself might have endorsed this turn to the left in the mid-1930s.
How was it that the actors and the writers ended up having the ability to sort of express those politics when it was seemingly the studio heads still controlled the process?
Right. Well, the studio heads were mainly out for money. They could tell which way the wind was blowing. They sort of, well, if you can make me money, that's great. And of course, there were some exceptions. The Warner Brothers were more liberal. I wouldn't know if you'd call them liberal, but they were known as sometime Democrats. So you did have one studio that was not quite in the conservative mainstream. So you can go through and see which studios released which movies, but, you know, by and large, you know, they wanted to make dough, and they would put that aside, if the politics wasn't quite to their liking.
And as we see this evolution, were the people working? I mean, I'm curious as to, was it just simply, was there some propensity that the writers and the actors had that would make them more to the left, I guess? Or was it simply that they were in some ways radicalized because of things like showing up and finding that, you know, a big chunk of your paycheck is going to fund somebody that you're not interested in funding?
Right. Well, that, like I said, in the book, I do trace that, the outrage that helped spark that. But, you know, they're creative types, and as we all know, creative types tend to be more liberal. And a lot of the writers had been imported from New York. This was the great era of, you know, Dorothy Parker, who's a major character in the book, F. Scott Fitzgerald, and William Faulkner, and so forth. All the great writers who had been imported from the East, who were writing screenplays. And so you did have this influx of people from outside. So certainly the screenwriters tended to be quite liberal, and actors were more divided, but you had plenty of liberal actors. And it was really the guild. I mean, the guilds that were formed in 1933 were slow to get going, but once they got going, you know, I suppose the book in a way is a hat tip to the power of unions. And gee, wasn't it great when people could really organize and change the world, or at least change their world? And so the book does have an epilogue that traces that, traces the growth of the guilds, what we see today. So it was a case of the key people in Hollywood organizing, and then being able to get better benefits for all, and being able to not, for example, get money deducted from their paychecks for Republican candidates.
How do you think that has evolved over time? You know, I've seen some discussion about, like, just for instance, the Oscars over the past couple of years. We've had a lot of very important sort of political documentaries, for instance, that
right.
have come out, and the Oscars seem to be sort of veering away from this. I mean, you know, I mean, in my sense of Hollywood now is that it's far less political in many respects.
Right.
I mean, you know, lifestyle.
I
maybe.
Think where it's where it is political, it still tends to be liberal, but certainly the focus is on blockbuster movies, on comic book heroes, 3D, and so on and so forth. So, Captain America is not going to move people to the left. And, you know, it's a dumbing down, lowest common denominator, et cetera, et cetera. So except for the, you know, tremendous rise of truly great and important documentaries, you know, the fiction side of Hollywood is you're getting fewer and fewer social issue movies. Now, a lot of them get nominated for Oscars. So if you watch an Oscars broadcast, you might say, wow, look at that. And look, you know, look at this movie and that movie. And, boy, they're still making great, you know, social issue movies, but it just tends to be that these may get, you know, get nominated for Oscars. But if you look at the overall number of movies that have those sorts of themes, they're certainly in decline. And so you do sort of have to look to documentaries today.
Yeah, and also, I mean, my sense is too is that there's a far less of an awareness, sort of a class consciousness in movies, you know, I mean, certainly from that time, but I mean, from, I know there's, you know, an ebb and flow to these things, but we, by all accounts, you know, the last 5 or 6 years have brought about in just about every facet of society, at least it seems to me, pockets of class awareness that Hollywood seems to be immune from. I mean, I mean, is that your sense?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's great separation. I mean, there always has been some separation from, you know, writers and actors from the real world. But of course, there's even more. I suppose you talk about the 1% of actors and writers in Hollywood as well. But, and I'm sure that contributes to it. But, you know, there's very little, sense that, you know, that there should be, you know, that social issue type movies need to be made or will do well at the box office. You know, they're competing with comic book movies. And, you know, thank God some still get made. And, you know, you can find them and catch up with them. But, you know, there's no pressure to do that. You get the George Clooney's and so forth, and they want to make a, you know, a really relevant movie every so often and so forth. But, you know, there's no real pressure for that. Even in the mid-1930s, you know, again, coming out of what I write about in the book, there were, you know, all sorts of movies that were made, agitation to make such movies. Yeah, we still had, you know, The Wizard of Oz and so forth. But, you know, there were terrific, hard-hitting movies as well. And
and we saw that in the early 70s, too, right? I mean, I feel like, you know, there was at least more responsiveness in the past to what was going on in the country than I think we see now. I mean, on some level, it seems Hollywood has become far more about just full-on escapism. Am I right? I mean, you know,
it's always been
that way. But, I mean, it just seems like there's even less responsiveness today.
Well, that's certainly true. It's the 70s was kind of a golden era. You know, you hate to sound like an old fogey, but you could trace the movies that were made in the 1970s. Even, I mean, a movie like Taxi Driver or something, you could say, well, was that really a social issue movie? But you look at what it chronicled and it's, you know, what it was looking at, it certainly was a lot different than the, you know, the Avengers or the animated films of today. So, Dog Day Afternoon and so forth. You know, movies you may not even think of as, you know, real social protest, but were steeped in social realism and you know, the issues of the day. So, it's been a slow decline. There's no question about it. And, you know, it's a shame. But, you know, in terms of politically, when we read about who the actors and people in Hollywood are donating to, what they're organizing for in campaigns, who's endorsing popular issues, doing, you know, PSA ads and so forth, it's still overwhelmingly on the left. And again, that's what I trace in the book, going back to this turning point in the mid 1930s. And you know, there's no question that the Hollywood community as a whole is liberal. What they do with that, or what kind of films they make, is, you know, is another matter.
Indeed. Well, Greg Mitchell, the ebook is When Hollywood Turned Left. We'll put a link to that on our site at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
Sure, Sam. Thank you.
All right, folks. Now, we've got a couple pieces of sound for you. The of course, on a Friday, or I should say Thursday, the CIA, the Senate Intelligence Committee, voted to have its executive summary of its 6,200-page report on our torture regime during the Bush administration released for or declassified. The executive summary, I think it was about 400 pages long. It goes to the administration. The president looks at it, and the primary agency responsible for signing off on the declassification of this report, of course, is just coincidentally the CIA, about whom the report gives a rather scathing assessment both of their own internal reporting of the value of torture and apparently also their recounting of exactly what they engaged in. This weekend, independent Senator Angus King was on Up with Steve responding to Dick Cheney's assessment that he'd do it all over again if he had the chance, because, of course, it wasn't really torture. Senator Angus King has a slightly different perspective. Here he is.
Now, having said all that, I sat and reread the entire report last week, the entire executive summary, which is the world's longest executive summary, 481 pages. It's shocking. And frankly, I was stunned to hear that quote from Vice President Cheney just now. If he doesn't think that was torture, I would invite him anywhere in the United States to sit in a waterboard and go through what those people went through, one of them 100+ odd times. That's ridiculous to make that claim. This was torture by anybody's definition.
Maybe we could provide a little incentive, like we do a pay-per-view thing, and it can go to fund the Dick Cheney Vice Presidential Library. I'm just thinking about how we could sweeten the pot for Cheney in that instance.
I'm thinking of waterboard-shaped columns to the library, actually.
Oh, that would be really good,
See?
Too. Yeah. And
that could work.
That might you could make it a whole theme library, and you can actually, like, participatory, sort of like a kid's science museum.
He leads you. He goes, now, kids, now we're entering the waterboard section, and you can strap the minority member of your school class trip into that chair over there and do a little experiment.
So further on the CIA report, former director of the CIA, Michael Hayden, went on the Chris Wallace Fox.
I think that's Fox News Sunday.
Fox
News Sunday.
And I guess, I don't know, taking a page out of the exonerating Chris Christie report filed by Chris Christie's own lawyers, Michael Hayden had this to say as to why the report is so damning, or why it's his sense that the report is so damning.
Yeah, I read an article by David Ignatius earlier this week. And he said,
he's a columnist for the Washington Post. Which
and he said that Senator Feinstein wanted a report so scathing that it would ensure that an un-American, brutal program of detention and interrogation would never again be considered or permitted. Now, that sentence, that motivation for the report, Chris, may show deep emotional feeling on the part of the senator, but I don't think it leads you to an objective report.
She's emotional. Come on, Chris. She's a lady. You know how they get. You know why they call it hysteria, don't they? Don't you, Chris?
Chris, I had heard that her grandson had not called to wish her a happy birthday. So I think we got to consider everything in context.
She's so against torture that she decided to write the report without leaving out certain things that probably are best for report. Yeah, let me just give you a sense of just how outrageous this comment is. Chris Wallace seems stunned.
I mean, forgive me, because you and I both know Senator Feinstein. I have the highest regard for her. You're saying you think she was emotional in these conclusions?
What I'm saying is, first of all, Chris, you're asking me about a report that I have no idea of its content.
Let me backtrack for a moment. I have no idea what's in there. I can just tell
by the contours of the report. I mean, come on, 480-page summary? That sounds pretty emotional to me. I don't know about you, but I mean, it's like one
this
of the
pages and pages. What is this, Jane Austen?
It's probably in all caps.
No one responsible for that report has spoken a word of it to me, to George Tenet, to Porter Goss, to anyone else who is actually involved in these events. So it's very hard for me to make a judgment.
But in the absence of anything, I can just say that, look, she's a lady. So take that for what it's worth. Look, you had a man who did this report, it'd probably be like one third the size.
Yeah, it would probably be a lot more concise, a lot more to the point. And yeah. But look. Chris.
And mathy. There'd probably be a lot more
math. Give me numbers. Chris, we live in a democracy, and we have decided that a lady could head the Senate Intelligence Committee. But being a realist in that democracy, I know that due to hot flashes, she will attempt to destroy the security apparatus. Now, I'm not saying that's wrong. That's her democratic right. But we need to consider all facts.
I haven't
here,
read it, but let's face it. I mean, postmenopausal women, it's just next question, please. All right, look, we're going
to. What about the evidence that torture had nothing to do with catching Bin Laden was a systemic violation of international law and the Constitution? Menopause.
Whoa, what are you, a lady?
Whoa, Chris, what did you get? Do too much tofu in your diet, buddy? You got estrogen? What's going on?
You got to lay off those panties, Chris. Unbelievable. All right, well, we're going to head into the funner half, in which time. We will talk about the latest bad news for Chris Christie. Like I say, the old saying, grand jury could indict a ham sandwich.
Maybe that lady in the Christie report, maybe she called up Dianne Feinstein for moral support. Dianne Feinstein was so upset by her being broken up with. And now next thing you know, the bridges are shut down. They're trying to destroy the CIA because they're so emotional.
They're so emotional. My gosh. We got to do something about this, Chris, about who can write reports, right? I mean, maybe there should be some type of, like, biometric thing on keyboards. So,
developing something at the NSA called the Reason and Woman Matrix, which really would apply here, Chris.
All right, folks. You can support this program by becoming a member today. Pennies a day it costs you. To continue with all the fun, just a little bit of housekeeping. On a Wednesday, we will have a special version of Matt and Mike Monday on Wednesday, as I will be in transit to Las Vegas for the Mass Torts Conference. There, we've got a bunch of great guests lined up for you, ranging from RJ Eskow to Shannon Moore, I believe, will be there. And then maybe Aaron Brockovich, I'm not sure. And also talk to some other plaintiff attorneys, trial lawyers. As you know, it's always been a long-standing feeling that these people are the last vestige of any type of fair regulation, the last opportunity we have to hold corporations accountable. Also, in the better half, we will talk about the jackbooted thuggery of these people who made it so hard for this guy to be CEO of Mozilla. It's just such a sad instance. Also, sex ed in Mississippi, they're not doing so well on that accord. And we will get to that GMO story. In fact, I may do it right up front, just so that we can get a little bit of the GMO-ness.
I'm going to just do a little teaser. Psych. Not going to happen. I'm just kidding.
All right, folks. You can also support this program. If you buy crap through Amazon, buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the link. Bookmark it. Always buy your crap that you buy through Amazon through that link. We get a kickback. That's why we call it MajorityReportKickback.com. Also, JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll take your phone call, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, or you can IM me through the app. You can get the app at MajorityApp.com. We'll be back in a moment.